Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome, everyone, to this Federalist Society Teleforum conference call, the last Teleforum conference call of this busy day. So thanks all for joining us. As this afternoon, April 21st, 2021, we're having another Courthouse Steps oral argument at Teleforum. Last but certainly not least, of a case called United States versus Gary. I'm Nick Marr, Assistant Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that expressions of opinion on our call today are those of our expert. And we're very pleased to be joined this afternoon by Professor Robert Leiter. He's an Assistant Professor of Law at Antonin Scalia Law School of George Mason University. Without further ado, Professor, thanks very much for being with us. I'll give the floor to you.
Thank you. So federal law prohibits the possession of a firearm by a convicted felon among certain other categories of individuals. And the federal government routinely prosecutes the offense. Felon in possession cases make up about 6,000 criminal cases a year, nearly 10% of the federal criminal docket. The penalty for violating the prohibition is steep, up to 10 years in prison. And so are the real world sentences. The average sentence is about 6 years. And this distribution is bimodal. So for those who have qualifying convictions under the Armed Career Criminal Act, the average is 15 years. For those who don't fall within the Armed Career Criminal Act, the average is about 4 years in prison. But in comparison with what state law generally punishes for gun possession, federal penalties are pretty steep. Now, in many cases, individuals may not realize that they fall within a prohibited category. So, for example, the felon in possession ban generally prohibits the possession of a firearm by a person who is convicted of a crime punishable by more than 1 year. But in many cases, given the way that criminal statutes are structured, the theoretical maximum penalty a person could have received is unclear, or is at least unclear for the defendant. So it often depends on which elements and sentencing factors are applied. The defendant himself may not know. Sentences, especially in state court, are often only a small fraction of the statutory maximum. So the defendant might have only received, say, a probation or short jail term and have no idea that his crime had a 3-year statutory maximum. And adding to the confusion, states define the misdemeanor felony distinction differently. So in Pennsylvania, for example, a misdemeanor of the first degree is punishable by up to 5 years in prison. So a person could very well think he's only been convicted of a misdemeanor, not realizing that some misdemeanors count as felonies under federal law. And in making it even worse than that, in some jurisdictions, the maximum potential penalty isn't clear. The state might still have common law crimes, or the state may not spell out exactly what the maximum penalty is in the statute. 2 years ago, in a case called Rahif versus United States, the Supreme Court held that Section 922G, which holds all of these status prohibitors, was not a strict liability offense. Now, that case didn't involve a felon. It involved somebody who was charged for being an alien unlawfully in the United States and possessing a firearm. The case involved a non-immigrant student who was on a student visa and left his school. And because he didn't re-enroll in a different school, his immigration status was terminated. And since he didn't leave the country, he was then unlawfully present in the United States. And so after the government learned that he had shot two firearms on a shooting range, the government indicted him for unlawful possession of a firearm by an alien unlawfully in the United States. And Rahif contended that he didn't know he was in the country unlawfully. And the Supreme Court reversed his conviction and held that the government must prove that a person was aware of the facts that constitute the prohibiting factor. Justice Alito issued a strong dissent, which in part warned about the fallout that the majority's decision would cause. The court's oral arguments yesterday were about that fallout. In United States versus Gary, which is today's teleforum, the court was presented with whether a defendant who pleaded guilty was automatically entitled to plain error relief if the district court did not explain to him that if the case went to trial, the government would be required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was aware of his status as a convicted felon. Now, the backstory on Gary was that a South Carolina police officer pulled him over for running a red light. He was with his cousin at the time, and Gary informed the officer that he was driving on a suspended license, which caused the officer to arrest him. The police later found a loaded gun and marijuana during inventory search of his vehicle. He was arrested under state law for possession of a gun by a convicted felon, and he was later charged under South Carolina law, which makes it generally illegal to carry a handgun. 5 months later, while Gary was out on bond, police officers ran into Gary and the same cousin, and the cousin had a marijuana cigarette in his lap. Gary and his cousin gave the officers permission to search their persons and their vehicle, and the search turned up a large quantity of cash, a digital scale, and in the car, a stolen firearm, ammunition, and a large amount of marijuana. The police then charged Gary again under state law, this time for possession of a stolen firearm. But on this incident, Gary caught the attention of federal prosecutors who charged him with two counts of unlawful possession of a firearm under federal law. And he pleaded guilty to both charges and he was sentenced to 84 months in prison. The state charges were ultimately dropped. Now, during the plea colloquy, the trial court informed Gary that the government would have to prove that he had been convicted of a crime punishable by imprisonment for a term exceeding 1 year, that he possessed a firearm, that the firearm had traveled in interstate or foreign commerce, and that he did so knowingly, that is, that he knew that the item was a firearm, and his possession of that firearm was voluntary and intentional. The district court, in accordance with the prevailing law of every circuit at that time, did not inform Gary that the government would have to prove that he knew his status as a convicted felon. Now, among the facts, the government had offered evidence that Gary had been convicted of 7 previous felonies. Gary agreed with all those facts, and he did not preserve any argument that the government had to prove his knowledge of his previous felonies. Now, when a person fails to object, courts still have some power to correct the mistake. So Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 52 states that a plain error that affects substantial rights may be considered even though it was not brought to the court's attention. And the court now looks at 4 prongs. First, whether there was an error which wasn't waived. Second, that it's clear or obvious. Third, that it affected the appellate's substantial rights. And if those 3 criteria are met, then fourth, that the error seriously affected the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of the judicial proceedings. Now, when Rahafe intervened in Gary's favor, Gary sought to get the benefit of the decision on direct appeal. And on appeal to the Fourth Circuit, both sides agreed that the judge's instruction constituted plain error because it admitted that the government had to prove the defendant's status as a convicted felon beyond a reasonable doubt. That the defendant knew of his status beyond a reasonable doubt. So that left whether the conviction affected the appellant's substantial rights. The government argued no. Gary was a convicted felon multiple times over. He obviously knew his status. But the Fourth Circuit held that it didn't matter. It held that the error to explain the elements properly constituted a structural error in the proceeding. Now, structural errors, the Supreme Court has explained, constitute a special category of forfeited errors that can be corrected regardless of their effect on the outcome in the individual case. And so these are errors such as racial discrimination in grand jury selection, the denial of the right of self-representation at trial, a lawyer who admits his client's guilt over the defendant's objection. So it's a very narrow set of categories of fundamental errors, and the court itself has been hesitant to expand this category. But the Fourth Circuit said that the failure to give the element deprived Gary of a meaningful choice whether to plead guilty, and that invalidated his plea. He didn't need to show any case-specific prejudice. The court denied a petition for rehearing en banc in a somewhat unusual opinion. Judge Wilkinson, joined by four other judges, concurred on the ground that the decision was so wrong that they shouldn't waste time with an en banc proceeding. It merited immediate Supreme Court reversal. That appears likely to happen. At oral argument yesterday, the government argued that Rahafe errors are not automatically prejudicial, and that there was no exception to the plain error requirement, even for those claims foreclosed by circuit precedent. That seemed to get a warm reception. On questioning from the Chief Justice, the government contended that omitting an element would never constitute structural error, that it may, of course, be relevant to whether the defendant can show prejudice, but the government was not willing to concede that this sort of error merited automatic reversal. The government said that, you know, there might be some cases where the colloquy was so defective that it would merit structural error, but that this was far away from that. For Gary, Jeff Fisher argued that there should be automatic reversal because failing to advise Gary on an element interfered with his basic due process rights, including his autonomy about whether to plead guilty or not. And Fisher repeatedly pressed that this was the molten core of due process. But Fisher received some difficult questions about the rule. Fisher's rule seemed to only apply when the circuits were unanimously against the defendant. And he received some questions on the Chief Justice about what that meant. But here he said that Fisher said that all the circuits were lined up against him, and not just all the circuits that had decided it, but literally every circuit. Justice Alito asked why elements are unique. What about other material omissions in the plea colloquy? Justice Kagan seemed suspicious about whether to allow automatic reversals, even in cases where it was abundantly clear that the defendant would not have done anything differently in pleading guilty. And Justice Gorsuch also pressed him whether defense counsel had some notice about whether knowledge of the convicted status would be required. And when Justice Gorsuch was a Court of Appeals judge, he had drafted an opinion suggesting that the knowledge element should be applied to the knowledge of the prohibited status. But the oral argument went rather briefly. A lot of the justices did not ask questions of one or the other advocate, and it appears likely that we're headed for a 9-0 reversal of the Court of Appeals. So with that,
Thanks very much, Robert. So now we'll open the floor to audience questions. And seeing no questions yet, Robert, you addressed my go-to question, which is, can you kind of read the tea leaves, see where this is going? Looks like we might be headed for a 9-0 reversal here. So any points that you didn't touch on, anything you were surprised by, any questions you were surprised by, anything like that?
I mean, I think the one thing I was surprised by most was the lack of questions. The argument went pretty quickly. There didn't seem to be a spirited debate. In terms of the underlying theory of it, I think this case is probably easier than the jury analog of this case. So there was a case in the late 90s called Nader versus United States, where the Supreme Court held that the failure to instruct the jury on an element of an offense did not constitute structural error over a spirited dissent from Justice Scalia. But I think the reasons for which Justice Scalia may have been right in that opinion don't really apply to the plea colloquy context, that having juries properly instructed on all the elements is essential, not just for the jury's role as a fact finder, but also for the jury's ability to show mercy in individual cases. So one of the classic functions of the one of the classic things juries have done historically, for example, is to nullify in part if they think sentences are too harsh. And so the kind of famous 18th century example is that juries would downvalue goods that were stolen to prevent the death penalty from being imposed. But those kinds of actions are impossible if the jury isn't instructed on an element and the judge just takes judicial notice of it. And to the extent that plea bargaining now takes place in the shadow of the jury, having that jury power on all elements of the offense is essential. But it seems less essential when the question is just one of pleading guilty. Presumably, in virtually all these cases, the defendant, I would say virtually all, but in most of these cases, the status of a convicted felon is known to the defendant. And so it's not really going to influence which direction to go. But the power, the likely outcome of a jury trial, I think, is much more essential for determining how plea negotiations will play out. And the court in Nader said that the failure to instruct wasn't structural error. And it would seem anomalous if it held that it was structural error in the plea bargaining context.
Great. That makes good sense. So we don't have any questions. One just popped up in the queue, so we'll go to it now.
Thanks for a very informative recounting of the case. My question is, does this idea of structural defect or structural error, does that have any history or basis in statute or constitutional precedent, or is that some fairly new invention, or where did that come from?
I think it came from the court's efforts to determine which errors merit automatic reversal and which don't. In the earlier days, all errors, no matter how trivial, would result in the reversal of a verdict. And the trend since the late 1800s and early 1900s has been not to reverse jury verdicts for petty technical reasons that did not affect the substance of the proceedings. And so, in the old days, you had any error in the instruction, you would get a do-over. But that position or that rule ended up causing a lot of waste of resources and wasn't seen as one that was conducive to justice. And so the rule had been, well, if it doesn't affect substantial rights, then disregard the error on appeal. And I think the courts, terms like structural error are definitely modern terms, but I think they are aimed at denoting a limited class of errors that would be essentially inherently prejudicial, and the types of things that might have been a clear paradigm case for reversal in earlier days, but today with the disregarding of harmless error, it's kind of a core set of errors that the court wants to preserve automatic reversal on, and not have to do an individual case by case showing. So I think the kind of convoluted answer to your question is that structural error is a modern construct, but it's probably rooted in determining which elements of a trial are so fundamental that even in an era of harmless error analysis, that there are certain errors that we're not willing to let slide.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, that was a great question. So Robert, seeing no questions right now, seems like we gave a very good review of the case and oral argument. Is there anything else you'd like to add, or if you'd just like to offer some closing remarks, and we might close up a little bit early this afternoon?
All right. Well, thank you. I don't have too much more to add to that. I mean, if you look at some of the arguments that were made in Gary's favor in the briefing, a lot of them have to do with concerns that plea bargaining is the modern criminal trial. And so what procedures are necessary to guard what is in essence the modern trial, which is a contract between the prosecutor and the defendant. But even here, I'm still, as I kind of indicated in my prior remarks, I'm still somewhat skeptical that disregarding that reversing any plea on a technical defect will meaningfully change the plea colloquy dynamic. I mean, I think there are legitimate concerns with the way that modern plea bargaining and the modern criminal justice system adjudicates cases. But I'm not sure that Gary's position is really an antidote to those problems. And I think the court was also impressed with just the sheer disruptiveness that the automatic reversal rule would cause. As I noted, felon in possession cases by themselves are 10% of the federal docket. It's just an extraordinary fraction for a single offense. And the court, I think, is not willing to see do-overs in any case that was pending on appeal, let alone having to sort out all the habeas and collateral review that would be required if it suddenly put this whole area in doubt, especially since in the mine run of cases, people are going to know that defendants are going to know their status. You know, for every person convicted of, say, driving under the influence of alcohol, where it was ambiguous whether the maximum sentence was 1 year or a year and a half or 2 years, there are many, many more defendants who have been convicted of very serious violent crimes or drug trafficking crimes. And I think the court is reluctant to give those defendants a windfall just for this kind of technicality. Now, Gary Fisher argued that it wouldn't necessarily result in a windfall. A lot of these defendants would plead out anyway. But that's not always true, and the longer proceedings go on, the more likely it is that evidence gets lost or witnesses forget or disappear. So it would have had a very disruptive impact. And I think what the court is saying is that going forward, the Rahafe rule will be applied, but that it's not willing to jeopardize all the previous convictions, especially in cases where the vast majority of cases in which the Rahafe error caused no prejudice whatsoever to the defendant.
Well, thanks very much, Robert. We haven't had any questions in the meantime, so that seems like it's been a place that I could make that down. So thanks very much for your thoughts and remarks on behalf of the Federalist Society. I want to offer you thanks for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise this afternoon. Of course, to our audience for calling in, for the great question we got. Just a reminder, we welcome your feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. Also, check your email accounts on our website for announcements of upcoming telephone calls like this one, Supreme Court argument and decision coverage, and registration for Zoom panel discussions. That's all that. Until next time, thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.